from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, nearly 10 years ago, in 2010, Instagram launched, Apple unveiled the iPad, and Uber's ride-hailing app went live in San Francisco. It's been quite a ride since then, and this hour, we'll talk about the consumer tech gadgets, from smart speakers to Apple Watches, and trends that defined the decade, as well as some notable failures. And we want to hear from you. From home devices to cloud computing, which of the decade's tech innovations do you love, which could you do without, or which ones actually worry you? We'll get started with Forum right after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we're taking a look back at the decade in technology, especially consumer products and trends that have really transformed the way we do just about everything. We're talking everything from the way smartphones have been integrated into pretty much everything we do, it seems. Smart speakers, ride-hailing apps, Instagram, you name it, along with some epic failures along the way. And joining us here in the studio, we have a stellar panel. Jeffrey Fowler is technology columnist for The Washington Post.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Sarah Fryer, tech reporter for Bloomberg. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian Chen is consumer technology writer for The New York Times. Welcome to you as well.
Hey there.
Well, let me begin by asking each of you, and Jeffrey, I'll ask you to go first. If you had to pick one or two things that really stand out to you for having had an impact in this wild decade of technology, what would they be, or what would it be?
Yeah, this was the decade of the smartphone, even though the smartphone was not invented in this decade.
Yeah, it was invented, what, 2007 or something?
That's when the first iPhone came out. That's right. So in many ways, I think a lot of what we're going to be talking about over the next hour are sort of the ways in which the smartphone kind of got integrated into our lives and in other ways turned us and our lives and our work and our thoughts and our bodies even into the product. And so there's a lot to unpack there. But with that in mind, something I would call out is Uber X. That launched in, I believe it was 2013. And it really kind of represents the gig economy that came to based in the smartphone, that came to redefine how folks even do work, that the idea that an algorithm could be your boss.
Yeah, we'll get into all those things. Sarah, what would you add?
Well, I think Jeff is right about the phone being so consequential, but I think there's another point to be made about algorithms and how...
Just explain what an algorithm is.
An algorithm is a way to organize information and personalize it for us. And so if you think about the prior decade, that was all about getting the information onto the internet. Everyone was excited about Web 2.0, the fact that we were all contributors to this vast store of knowledge on the internet that could be accessible by anyone. This decade has really been the decade where that has been personalized, ordered. Everyone has sort of their own version of the internet that they're consuming, created for them, and that has really changed a lot about how we interact with the world.
And created for them, in some cases, without their even knowing it.
Without their even knowing it, it's a very – people expect information to come to them more now than they used to in the prior decade, and as opposed to going to look for something. You expect to be entertained, to be served up, content from your friends and family and from the news that is automatically tuned to your preferences.
And so it becomes something of an echo chamber.
Absolutely. And I think it sort of creates a different slice of reality for every single person living today. We don't know what everyone else's experience is of technology because it's all different.
Brian?
I think parallel to the smartphone, this was the decade of tablets as well. The first iPad was introduced in 2010, and there was a lot of debate going on at the time about whether or not they're going to be for consumption or productivity, but I think at this point, it's indisputable that the tablet has made a pretty impact on society. Like, if you walk into any coffee shop or restaurant, everybody's using some sort of tablet to check you out and take your credit card and so on. So it's just an age of multiple connected screens, if you will.
And what does it mean, do you think, down the road, or has it meant already, for laptops?
I think, like, currently the tablet has replaced some aspects of a laptop. It hasn't eliminated the laptop entirely, as some people had predicted. But it definitely, for some people who especially those who don't know how to use computers very well, it's replaced the laptop for needs like, using Netflix or a web browser, so on, email, things like that.
And more secure.
Yeah, it's almost like, more secure. It's a sandbox environment, they call it. You don't need to run antivirus software on an iPad, for example. So it's almost like the automatic computer for average people.
And Jeffrey, as you pointed out, the iPhone, although it's been integrated so into so many things in this decade, was invented in 2007, rolled out by Apple. To what extent do you think the makers of the iPhone could foresee what this was going to become?
This depends on whether we believe Steve Jobs was a genius who could see into the future as he's been.
Well, I ask that because I have a friend who I don't think he works there anymore, worked for Apple. And I remember him telling me a long time ago, like, it's all going to be on the phone. And it didn't really make sense to me at the time, but, you know, he was right. And I'm sure others thought of it before he did.
Right. But remember, when the iPhone launched, it did not have an app store. And it wasn't until that came around a year or two later that it really opened up this idea of all the things that a phone could do, that it wasn't just a phone. It was a computer and could be now, as popular to say here in Silicon Valley, a platform that could be a place to work, could be a place to express yourself, so many different things. So I think one other thing that happened during the decade to the smartphone that really helped shape our relationship with it is some ideas about app design that became popular. The endless scroll. So that's when you go to an app like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram and you're just constantly going through it. And there's like a reason. You kind of get this habitual thing where you're just kind of petting it, letting it keep flowing by, never reach the end. And related to that is the alert, right? When we've
seeded notifications.
The notification. Yeah, we've seeded our control over our attention and our brain to a company, to an app maker.
Well, and talk about the changes to the brain that all this technology has brought about, especially for kids, I think, who grow up with it.
Well, I think you have to talk about the killer app for the iPhone, which is Instagram. I mean, that is really the thing that transformed the phone from something that's kind of in the background, a tool that we use to, you know, get driving directions, et cetera, into something that becomes a part of our daily experience.
What is it about Instagram that made it so?
So Instagram started out as a way to present your life in a sort of curated, beautiful fashion. Instagram doesn't have a reshare button the way Twitter and Facebook does. So everything you put on Instagram is from you. And in the beginning, the iPhone photos were not very high quality. It wasn't very good. And Instagram had these filters that could automatically make you feel like a great photographer. And so people started using Instagram to capture just, you know, everything in their lives, their neighborhoods, their friends, random things they were doing. And over time, it became a more curated experience and has now changed the way we think about our lives. At the end of the decade, we have people doing things in order to post them on Instagram. So instead of just reflecting what we do in our lives, it has changed the way we behave.
Is that a good thing, Brian?
I think there's pros and cons, right? There's a lot of talk right now about smartphone addiction, right? When it comes to doing stupid things while you're using a smartphone, like driving, for instance, which we all know is a bad idea, right? Distracted driving. I would say even distracted walking. You see plenty of people looking at their phones while they're crossing a crosswalk, which is not a very safe thing to do.
Well, and now I think at least the iPhone will suggest that you not use your phone because it knows you're driving, right? Because of the GPS?
Yeah, there are tools to curtail this addiction means that even the tech companies acknowledge that it's kind of a problem at this point, right? Like when you're driving, the iPhone will tell you not to touch your phone. There's like an option to turn that on.
Do they really mean that?
I would add one other thing on top of what y'all have said, which is this powerful idea that really Instagram helped refine, which is the intermittent variable reward. This is an idea.
The strongest kind, right?
There you go. This is an idea borrowed from Vegas, from the slot machine. Every time you open that Instagram app or the Facebook app, but particularly Instagram, you might get a dopamine hit of likes. Mm-hmm. And so you're drawn to just come back and look at it again and again. And they really figured out how to turn that both into a money-making machine, but also it can be weaponized against our attention and even sort of our view of the world.
Yeah, and against our elections as well. Talking with three outstanding journalists who cover this field of technology, Jeffrey Fowler from The Washington Post, Sarah Friar from Bloomberg, and Brian Chen from The New York Times. Let's open up the phone lines because I am guessing a lot of our listeners want to join into this conversation. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. Or, of course, you can reach us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us if you like, forum at kqed.org. And here's a tweet from Wayne, who writes, I'm slowly changing with the times. I had a flip phone until 3 or 4 years ago. Now I use my smartphone as a computer for searches, social media, texting, and, of course, phone conversations. Yeah, it's almost like that part of it, the use of, like, on the phone talking to somebody is almost like an afterthought.
Absolutely. I think that generally we look to our phones to entertain us now and to be a part of whatever we're doing and help us make decisions, but not so much for calling.
And there's a generation of young people who think that a call involves a video picture of their auntie or uncle, whoever it happens mm-hmm. to be on the other end of that FaceTime or Skype chat, because that's what a call has become.
Well, I remember, you know, growing up watching the Jetsons. That's how old I am. And they had these screens where people could see each other. And that's kind of what it's become, although it seems like it's not, Brian, as popular as you might think it would be.
You mean video chatting?
Yeah, video chatting.
I plenty use FaceTime and video chatting with family members, and I see people doing it quite often. What about you guys?
I don't tend to do it as much just because I don't have as many children in my life. I think that people tend to use video chat a lot when you're trying to talk to kids, right? Because that's the way for the grandparents to see how they're growing up.
In fact, I was talking to my nephew the other day.
Exactly.
And had to see little Amalia.
And the way young people hang out is through video chat. So for somebody who doesn't have kids, I think that it's less of a factor. I use my phone more professionally. But I do think that it has become ubiquitous for people who are young and people who have young children.
It depends on the context too, right? I mean, Snapchat is kind of video chatting, right? If you're taking a video and you're sending it to your friends. My office uses Google video conferencing for meetings, you know, Google Hangouts and things like that. So going beyond just looking at the phone as like a video chatting thing like the Jetsons, I think video chatting has gotten pretty big actually.
Jeffrey?
And it's related to something Brian was saying before about the iPad. So in addition to all those other things the iPad has become in our lives, it has become the electronic babysitter, right? Mm. So we have this generation who's grown up, and every time they go on a plane, they get iPad for a certain number of hours. So there's just a relationship with a screen that I think is different.
How many of you have concerns about that? Whether or not you have kids, you know, I mean, what that kind of thing is doing. And then that means less interaction with parents, which for parents is a great respite from having to tell their kids to, you know, whatever, be quiet.
I do, but I think it's a complicated conversation to have. Not all screen time is the same. There's some excellent screen time that you can have, some screen time that can build all kinds of skills, can even build social relationships. So I think we have to be sort of thorough in how we have that conversation.
And Brian, a few years ago, you may have written the article. There was an article in the Times about how some of the tech moguls won't let their kids have access to some of these things until I think they're 10 or 11 because they know.
Oh, right. I remember the article now. I think it was called At What Age Should Your Child Get a Smartphone, right? And there were a bunch of people debating, like, what is the right age to give your kid a phone? And I think that's still up for debate, but a lot of people were agreeing that when the kid goes to high school is probably the right time because they have extracurricular activities and it makes more sense for them to gain access to, you know, that wealth of information and applications and be able to be accessible like that. But I think that seems to be where the consensus has landed.
I want to bring some of our listeners in a second, but Jeffrey, you mentioned UberX and the gig economy, which of course is huge and will continue playing out in the coming decade as well, politically and in many, many ways. And just as that really disrupted the taxi industry. Almost everything we're talking about this morning has disrupted some. We haven't talked about Spotify and Pandora, Netflix streaming. I mean, all these things have really disrupted major sectors of our economy, Hollywood, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood is a great one in terms of the gig economy. I think I would take that a step further and say the ability to become famous no matter who you are. I think that's really in the idea of kind of snackable content. Back to those intermittent dopamine rewards that you can get from using social media, you can also get a life-changing reward of virality and fame. Even Brian has a famous dog.
I tried to make him famous.
You tried.
Semi-famous.
What's his name?
Micro-influencer, right?
An Instagram corgi called Cooking with Fat Max. I talked to Kai Rizdal about this a while ago. And even that didn't make him famous. But, I mean, I think the reality is like...
There's a lot of fat pets out there.
Right. You were talking about Instagram, you know, back in the day and how it kind of changed photography. And I think back then it was easier to become viral. But now, like, Instagram has become like this platform where you have all these really high production photographers coming together, like showing off like really like glossy photos or just like, you know, really well polished, highly produced photos of great equipment and that kind of thing. So,
and one of the selling points of these new iPhones is really the improved photography, right?
That's what they want.
That's what they want you to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you saying? Not so much?
Sure, they are better, but...
How much better can they be?
Exactly. One thing that's really happened to smartphones in the last 5 years is sales have slowed down considerably.
Yeah, prices have gone up.
As prices have gone up and the improvements have not been that much better. So even as we talk about the smartphone being this kind of like critical linchpin to so many aspects of our economy now... It's tougher times over there at Apple and Samsung in terms of getting people to upgrade to new ones.
Well, and what about the Apple Watch? Who wants to weigh in on that? Success? Failure?
I have one. Do you guys have one?
I don't have one. I know a lot of people that do, but I don't.
I have one, and I think it belongs in our list of the most important tech of the decade because it represents an idea that Apple did not invent, because Apple doesn't usually invent new technologies. It just sort of refines them. The idea is that there's a piece of technology, a computer that you wear on your body that will make you healthier. 15 years ago, that idea would have seemed crazy to us. Now, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people around the world are doing that and sending data about their body to a tech company. That really sets us up for what's going to come in the next decade when tech companies want to colonize their next area of our lives, which is our health.
Well, and that sort of raises another issue, which is privacy, which has kind of gone out the window, I think, especially for younger people who've grown up with this technology.
And you have companies like 23andMe and Ancestry that are sequencing your DNA.
I keep getting emails about all the new relatives I have.
Right. I keep getting ads about all sorts of other tech that can make me healthy. You know, things that can tell me if I've got wellness, right? What does wellness mean? Who knows? But a lot of tech companies want to sell it to me, and so I think that Jeff is right that's a huge shift in the way we think about technology and how it, in some ways, it's kind of replacing, though it shouldn't, it's kind of replacing a doctor checkup.
What about like Fitbit? Is that just another example? It's not a smartphone, but it's same idea,
right? It got bought by Google. But I think currently like health technology in general is in this nascent stage. I mean, the implications are really interesting for what it's going to solve for us in the next 5 to 10 years. But I think currently consumers don't really know what to do with the data, right? Like they collect all this data with a watch or with a Fitbit or whatever. Like, for example, I tried tracking my sleep for like 2 months or something. Maybe it was 3 weeks, sorry. And I didn't really know what to do with the information because I found that, like, well, I sleep like crap, so what does that even mean? Like, what do I do, right? And, like, I already knew that I did. And
doesn't the watch have a suggestion of what to do?
Not really. I mean, they're currently in that stage where they're giving you the data, but you have to figure out what to do with the data yourself.
Are you getting ads now from, like, you know, sleep companies?
Not yet, but that's a great idea.
I'm surprised.
I'm surprised.
Let's go to the phones because we do have some folks ready to talk. 866-733-6786. And let's begin with Gavin in Walnut Creek. Hi, Gavin.
Hey, Scott. I got a quick question comment. So the proliferation of apps, and the first one that comes to mind is Gab, have had a huge influence on our youth, I think. Well, not our youth. Well, first they... kind of are a haven, in my opinion.
Can you say what Gab is, if you would?
I'm pretty sure it's like an offshoot of Facebook or Twitter. but it's more so designed for people who are not really, quote, PC. It allows people who are might be misogynistic or racist to thrive. And I think that these are not as regulated as they should be. In a way, I don't think they monitor their participants,
yeah.
Their users.
Jeffrey, you want to jump in on this? Hold one sec, Evan. Yeah.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that Sarah actually pointed out before. She mentioned that this was the decade of algorithms, right? And a part of that is filter bubbles, this idea that we can all live in these own separate universes online that are curated for us. And so if we have a San Francisco liberal point of view, that's the world that we think exists. Or if we have, you know, a white supremacist point of view or a word only knows kind of view, you can have that world too. And we've seen that also be weaponized by all sorts of forces, by people who want to do harm to society, by foreign governments in the election. And so that is, I think, what the caller's getting at a little bit here, that this world of apps and algorithms has allowed people to exist in these separate worlds and can be manipulated.
And is Gab, as he describes, I mean, is it used sort of for these, you know, sort of fringy groups?
That's its reputation.
Yeah. Okay. Gab,
the other issue is encryption. I mean, as more of us decide to go into our sort of secluded communities of thought where we feel like we won't have to deal with the mainstream point of view, a lot of those groups are private and encrypted to the point where not even the government can see what people are talking about and not even the companies can see. And we're seeing companies like Facebook shift in that direction for apps like WhatsApp, where, you know, even if we wanted to hold people accountable for what they're saying, there's no technical way to see it.
So he's correct that I don't know who makes Gab, you know, where that comes from. Do y'all know anybody?
That's something I follow. So.
It's a small company.
Yeah. And so there is no real mechanism to regulate them. And maybe, you know, should they even be regulated? I mean, is it so fringy that maybe it doesn't matter? That's a bigger question.
That is one of the central tensions of this moment. We've seen a variety of folks in Silicon Valley trying to lay out their perspective on that. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has come forward and said that he doesn't think that tech companies should be responsible for making decisions about what kind of speech is okay or not. And yet we have rules and laws in this country against hate crimes, and they can definitely take place on some of these apps and platforms.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter, I mean, many people see it as sort of a sewer of hatred and racism. I mean, there's other things on it, but there's certainly a fair amount of that, right?
And anonymity.
Yeah.
I think anonymity, you know, I think Zuckerberg wanted to usher in an era of everyone being their own identity on the internet, but there's still a lot of havens for people to be whoever they want to be.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our guests, Jeffrey Fowler, Sarah Fryer, and Brian Chen. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join us. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Or, of course, you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Join us. Stick around. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today. We're talking about the decade, looking back at the 2010s in technology, especially consumer technology. My guests are Jeffrey Fowler, tech columnist for The Washington Post, Sarah Fryer, tech reporter for Bloomberg, and Brian Chen from The New York Times. And I'll give out the number one more time. It's 866-733-6786. And let's go to Brian in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Going well.
I'm loving this conversation. I'd love to hear the panel's thoughts on the issue of the digital divide. So we have a lot of great technology that's arrived in the last decade. So far, we've been talking about wonderful gadgets and how they can change our lives. I actually volunteer in public schools and was interested in being able to tutor kids remotely. And I was told, you can't do that because we can't assume that students have access to computers or tablets or that they have Wi-Fi in their homes or access to broadband. So I think there's one impact of the advent of technology, which is leaving a lot of people behind. And I'm just curious what your panel's thoughts are about that.
Yeah. Jeffrey?
It's a really interesting and complicated topic, because when we first started talking about the digital divide, we assumed it was going to be this issue that, like, oh, people just couldn't get computers at home. But then the smartphone came along, and for many folks, both in the U.S. and around the world, leapfrogged over computers for access. But that doesn't mean that everybody's equal. So now if you've got a smartphone that is connected to the internet, can you do all the things that you can do on a physical computer? Can you apply for a job? Can you, can you do work at home? Can you do homework? Can you get tutoring? So that's one conversation we've been having about it. I think another one is we thought that that computers and tablets were going to sort of make everybody equal by allowing giant online courses, sometimes called MOOCs, massive online courses, to sort of spread around schools. And that was one of the big hopes of this decade, that the internet would really level out education. And it hasn't really come true. It turned out to be much more complicated to teach folks over the internet than we thought.
And is that a function of the quality of the education or other things? I mean, you can't expect one invention or even just technology generally to erase all the other inequities in a society.
Well, it turns out that that teaching is complicated. Teachers will already tell you that. So trying to mediate that through a screen involves all sorts of new skills and new ideas that we just really haven't figured out entirely yet.
All right. And there's still like huge swaths of, I mean, California, I think, and certainly the country that don't have access really to broadband, right?
Well, I would note also that even people who do get access to technology, either, you know, smartphone is their first introduction to technology or whatever it may be, later on in this decade, they may not have the ability to discern truth from falsity or scams from reality. I mean, the people who have had access to these tools for decades understand what to look out for and where you may be getting information from, you know, an actual university versus a conspiracy theorist on YouTube. And it's very difficult to bring people on the internet in some countries where, you know, Facebook is the entire internet for that population.
Brian, thanks very much for the call. Let's get some comments here from, let's see, Chris writes, one specific change that I think has happened is streaming. Network TV is probably dying. Any thoughts about that? Is it that dramatic?
I mean, we're definitely in this streaming revolution right now, right? Like with Apple Plus joining and as well as Disney, pretty much everybody is paying more for subscriptions than they used to. And I think we're going to be seeing more cord cutting in general. But in addition to streaming video, there's streaming music, and that already disrupted the music industry. So I think we can expect it to continue disrupting the video industry and getting people to cancel their cable subs.
Would you expect to see more players in that, you know, space, either like, you know, in addition to, say, Spotify and Pandora, or is it so, do they have such control already that there really isn't room?
When it comes to music, it seems like Apple and Spotify are the two big players. Amazon is trying to gain traction too. And I mean, I think there's a lot of talk about antitrust, amid big tech becoming increasingly interwoven in our lives. And I think that's something that regulators are looking at, right? Like, is it too late for another a third competitor to come.
Jeffrey?
And this is part of a bigger trend that's happened over the last decade, which is we don't own our stuff anymore. We rent it, right? Remember, like, 15 years ago when you had that iTunes collection? I mean, if you got a new computer, you had to move it over and you had to keep track of it and you had to whatever. Like, when's the last time you, like, played around with your iTunes music collection or your movie collection or your DVD collection or even your photo collection, right?
And yet, like, vinyl's making a comeback.
Not
so much. Hipsters.
We're here to talk about tech. But this whole idea that we're living our lives in the cloud, as they call it, right, where we rent space, we rent entertainment, it's all a service that we pay for, I guess until we die, this is part of what has made tech companies the most valuable companies on Earth, because they figured out a system to get us all to pay a tax.
Recurring revenue. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a lot of talk about, you know, consumers should have more control over that. They should perhaps get money from that. They should be able to sell their data. Some of that is happening, I think, maybe in Europe. The EU has regulations that are a little more robust than we do.
It's very hard to change the entire business model of all of these companies. And yes, I mean, Facebook has recently released a tool where you can download your data and move it. I mean, are people going to do that? People become sort of set in the way they use these technologies, and they don't necessarily know what the benefit is in the network and in having the services all in one place and in the convenience. And so as much as people talk about privacy and how to fix these issues, it's not clear what the solution would be.
Yeah. All right, let's read some more comments here. Manu writes, I'm an avid traveler, and in the past several years, I've seen a mounting movement of younger travelers who go somewhere to recreate a picture they saw on Instagram. Wow. They hire a photographer, they travel with a wardrobe just for this purpose, and they seem to ignore the culture, the history, and the reality of the place they actually find themselves in. Have you heard about this, Brian?
Yeah, the FOMO era, right?
Fear of missing out.
Yeah, everybody wants to induce FOMO for their friends by going and taking that perfect Instagram picture of whatever tourist attraction, right? And that's part of the phenomenon. Not only that, I've heard of people hiring photographers just to take selfies for them, right? Like just like really glamorized photos that are just really beautifully shot that they can post on Instagram as well. So kind of an age of self-vanity, if you will.
All right. Let's see. Jeff writes, millennials think it's impolite to call unless you text first. The expectation is that if you text, you expect that person will make an immediate decision whether to chat. So all must pay constant attention to their text app.
Not only text before you call, but text before you press a doorbell. That's a big thing with millennials as well, even though now many of us have these doorbells that have cameras in them and you can know who's there and you get an alert even before they approach.
Is it just a time saver? I mean, what is it about texting that has made it so prolific? You don't have to, have a conversation. It's just quicker. It's more efficient.
I think
what
it is that knowledge that everyone has their phone on them at all times, mm-hmm. and that if you text them, it's less disruptive. Because if you call them, what if they're in a meeting? What if they're in some movie theater? Like you don't know where someone is, and so texting seems more polite in some ways.
I think they call that asynchronous communication. So the idea that you can send a message and you don't have to respond right away. You can respond when you're ready, and that just generationally feels more comfortable.
And you pretty much talk to dozens of people at the same time.
Yes, you can. Rob in San Francisco, you're next. Welcome.
Thank you. I've thought of one other little quick comment, but I had a comment on the reliability of software. My wife teaches PE, and she has noticed that the kids over the last 10 years have slowly really lost their attention span. They're much more, jump out and have to talk without any idea of having patience. And it's just she notices that she thinks it's the smartphones and the constant addiction to technology has changed kids.
I've heard that from teachers as well. Yeah.
Yeah. But my comment was in the rush to bring out the latest and greatest features to get people to upgrade their phones or whatever, their tablets, offering them more things you can do with your technology, it seems like they don't think about the reliability of software enough. I've spent so much of my time trying to get technology to just work. This promise of all these things that we can do with technology is great, and so it gets us into buying it. But then when you try to use it, it seems like there's too many places where you just have to spend time fixing things that just break.
Some
of these apps
agree.
That just quit working and it's all these promises that are kind of being unkept by technology.
Rob, can I just ask, how old are you?
I'm 56.
Okay. Brian?
I'm 35, but I still think smartphones in general have gotten too hard to use. I mean, and they were supposed to be easier to use than computers back when they were coming out, but they've become increasingly complex. I think it's because of the pressures that the tech companies put on their engineers. They put them on these annual schedules to put out these annual software updates, these big software updates, along with the hardware updates to seem more competitive with the rest of the industry, right? And in doing so, by focusing on new features, they're not focusing on polishing existing features. And that's why we're seeing, especially if the iPhone and iOS 13 this year coming out the plethora of bugs, right? And overall, just a lot of frustration among consumers.
Let me share my number one tech tip.
Yeah.
If it's broken,
turn it off.
If it's not working, restart it.
Restart it. That's what our IT people always say. Have you tried turning it off and starting it again?
90% of your problem.
Really? Okay. Good to know. Rob, thanks very much. During the break, we were chatting about a huge innovation, which is smart speakers, Alexa, for example. How many of you, just show of hands, how many of you have a smart speaker at home? Two of you. Why not, Sarah? I don't have one either.
I'm a journalist. I have a lot of
concerns.
Conversations, you know, I just privacy. I don't want, we just at Bloomberg Businessweek put out this big investigation about how, you know, although these speakers say that they only record you after a wake word, you might not know when that wake word is triggered. And so in order to improve the AI, they're recording clips of people's voices and sending them to human transcribers who work as contractors for the companies, who are trying to check the AI on its work. So when you think that you're just getting this machine translation, you're actually getting an apparatus of human listeners behind it. And so I think there's a lot more to know and to dig into about the privacy aspect.
And Brian, Jeffrey, why are you not concerned about this?
I think we're both in the business of evaluating products, and so we have to keep testing these things. But that's my personal reason.
I have all three that live next to each other on a shelf, and someday they're going to talk to each other. But I did an experiment earlier this year where I went back. So I had one of the very first Amazon Echoes with Alexa in it. And I went back and I listened to all the recordings it had made of me and my family over the last 4 years. Mm. And it was pretty terrifying, actually. Because as Sarah was saying, that thing goes off all the time. There were recordings of family members talking about medication, a friend doing a business deal, lots of recordings of Downton Abbey for some reason. It seemed to go off a lot during that. But I think what I learned from that is that, earlier you said that privacy's dead. Young people don't care about privacy. I disagree. I think our conversation about privacy is shifting into a conversation about transparency. And the problem was, and the problem for me is that Amazon isn't really being honest with people about how much it's recording and what it's doing with our data. And I am very hopeful that we are actually entering a new decade where people are going to expect transparency from companies. That's about accountability. And if they don't have it, then we won't trust them. And I think that applies even to young people too.
How did you find all those recordings? Is anybody able to do that?
Turns out that Amazon keeps a copy of all of them by default. And even worse, doesn't give you the option to turn that off. I hope you're listening, Amazon. Yes, I work for the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos. But I'm at liberty to say anything I want to about its products. And Amazon Echoes and Alexa products suck because they do not let you stop them from recording you by default.
Yeah, and so Brian, do you turn it off at some point during?
I personally have the microphone kill switch on all the time with the Amazon products, and I mean with any of the smart home products constantly.
How do you use it then?
Well, I disable the kill switch when I actually want to use it to test something, but you know that thing is constantly glowing red because it's not really working.
And there's no way for Alexa to override that?
I mean, assuming they're telling the truth with that red light, meaning that the microphone is off, you know. But I personally use like the Spotify app, and I on the iPhone, I press play on a song track, and that's how I use it.
What are the implications? I mean, smart speakers have incredible penetration in the market, right? I forget what the number is, but they've been adopted by, you know, almost as quickly, I think as smartphones, right?
Maybe a third of Americans have.
I thought it was even more than
30%.
You know what they are? They're gateways. They're gateway drugs to a couple of things. First of all, Amazon convinced millions of us to do work for them. We think that we're just getting something out of this speaker, some music or an answer to a silly question or a fart joke or whatever it is you ask Alexa for. But in fact, they're taking our voices to train their AI. So that was one of the big shifts here, right? That we are the product in many of these cases. Our voice is the product. The other thing that these smart speakers have done is they are gateways for all kinds of data being collected about our lives and our homes. They're hubs for smart gadgets around the house, thermostats and garage doors and light switches. And turns out Amazon as well as Google is collecting data about each one of those things whenever you connect them to it. And I think there's this whole sort of world of what I've been calling sort of the secret life of the data in our lives that we are very unaware of, but we all need to pay more attention to.
Brian?
I would add that Amazon wanted it to be a portal for people to buy things, right? And nobody is really doing that. No one's asking. I don't want to say the A word because some people might have the speaker.
You can change the name, can't you? If there's an Alexa living in the house.
You can change it to Amazon, yeah.
You can change it to computer like Star Trek because Jeff Bezos is a nerd.
I'll tell you what I worry about. I mean, I think that you know, when at the beginning of this conversation, I talked about how our use of technology has become more and more personalized and passive. I think that as we shift to these artificially intelligent devices, from a user perspective, we're going to become used to tech companies telling us the answer to things and just feeding us whatever we ask for. And we're going to lose some of our critical thinking skills as a society. And it's already been happening. You see people, you know, when you Google something, you get that Google answer at the top. You don't need to click into anything. As tech becomes easier, more convenient, we start to stop questioning what we're being told, and we rely a lot more on these algorithms to serve us up information.
Well, and I would think young kids are thinking, well, why do I have to learn that? I can just Google it.
Exactly. And you assume that it's accurate, but it's not necessarily. It could be full of misinformation or wrong information. And I hope that as a society, we're still able to build those skills of critical thinking in order to make important decisions about how to move forward.
Jeffrey?
Totally. The downside is also power. We're letting a giant corporation decide what the answer is to something. That's the algorithm.
Don't we already do that with, say, like history books?
Well, at least there's been diversity. When you had to go to the library to like
– they all come out of Texas.
But if you had to go to the library to look up information, there might be competing sources. Or even back in the day when we had to go to a newsstand to look at, you know, get some information, we would see Forbes right next to Rolling Stone, and you could see that there was a diversity of points of view. Then going back to what Sarah said at the beginning, when algorithms get to decide your view of the world – or just what the answer is, you're not seeing that diversity.
It's happening in photography too, right? Like the way that photos look is what Google or Apple think is the best way to present a photo using algorithms. And that's probably the most obvious example, right?
All right, back to the phones. Jonathan in Oakland, welcome.
Hey, what's going on? We have gone in such a rabbit hole discussion here in the past few minutes. My initial comment was about the gentleman who called about his wife or somebody who was a professor talking about how the students don't have the same attention span. And I counteract that argument with maybe the fact that that teacher might not be interesting or, frankly to say it, boring. A lot of teachers can't keep their students' attention because they don't know how to utilize technology to keep their attention. You're telling so many students to adapt to the teacher when in reality, the teacher should be adapting to these students. These students are the future.
Sarah?
If you can't keep their interest, yeah, you're going to lose them. This whole thing about keeping information, what's accurate and what's not, this is where critical thinking does come into play. You need to learn how to figure out what's actually truthful. Some people will see the first thing they see and run with it, and that's how rumors get started.
Sarah?
I will just take this a step further and say that the younger generation understands how to create entertaining content. It's really interesting to see an entire group of youth who grew up with the internet, who have been exposed to smartphones, and who think about themselves in terms of their personal brand from a very young age. And so, yeah, maybe the teacher is not entertaining in the way that the young people understand entertainment. But you know, we have to understand that the youth are all content creators now. They all understand how to communicate in a way that is snappy, edited, entertaining to their friends. And it's going to be really interesting to see what kinds of changes that makes to our media environment over time. I don't necessarily know about that teacher, but I do want to say that, you know, the youth are very creative.
Yeah. Jonathan, a quick comment back.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not – sometimes I think it's a bad thing to say the word boring, but I get it. We don't want to have that conversation yet. We're working on it. We'll get there one day.
All right, Jonathan, thanks so much. And, you know, Sarah, you talk about creating content. Let's talk about TikTok, the Chinese app that you can make short videos and share them with people. I think there are some 500 million users worldwide. What is TikTok, and why is it so popular?
Well, TikTok is an evolution of – of something that, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, Vine was another short video app that Twitter owned.
Those are like six-second videos.
Six-second videos. TikTok, you can do either 15 seconds or 60 seconds, and you can attach it to music. And it has this call and response of kind of functionality to it where you can respond to people in video. There's a lot of lip syncing. It's supposed to be very fun and entertaining. I think TikTok is an example of how we are more than happy to submit ourselves to the algorithm and say, show me whatever will entertain me. Because one of the things that people like about TikTok, which is also the biggest problem with TikTok, is that it's so curated and so personalized that you will only see things that make you happy. And
as opposed to making you
well,
what?
Well, you know, algorithmically, they don't have a lot of controversial content rise to the top. They're trying to make you laugh and trying to make you smile. And, you know, you'll see some people who say, you know, that's censoring the Hong Kong protests, for example, or things that should bubble up in society to the forefront.
Well, is there also just, Brian, I know you want to jump in, but is there also a concern about, I mean, that
Chinese
it is
ownership?
Chinese?
Yeah. It is the first, I mean, it's significant that it's the first social media app owned by China to make really big forays into the U.S. and gain a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. Brian?
I mean, I was just going to add, I had to ask a 20-something-year-old recently what they do with TikTok, and I felt like such a boomer for having to ask that, right?
And you're 35.
The okay boomer meme.
Mindset.
And she explained that she spends an hour before going to bed just watching TikTok videos, and they just play on this constant stream, just like, you know, Sarah was saying. This is all just recommended, like curated content, and it's almost like on autoplay. This is all you do before you go to bed. So this is just a bizarre concept to me.
Even stodgy old news organizations are trying to figure out TikTok. The Washington Post is pretty big on TikTok. I've been on it a couple times. We have a feed that's done by a guy in D.C., and just sort of a lot of it's just fun glimpses into the newsroom to try to just get a different generation to kind of understand who we are, how we work, what goes into making newspapers that were fun, that but even sometimes show a little bit of the newsmaking process. I made one when Apple released the new iPhone 11, the one with three cameras on the back, and I made a TikTok inside their event, which, you know, so speak to the youth.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Elizabeth writes, I tried to look up health and safety information about the 5G network, and I found none. Help, she says. 5G? Are there health concerns? Should there be?
It's really like
Say what that is.
People are, I mean, okay, so 5G is a next generation cellular network, right?
And, faster.
It's faster, but the big picture implication is it's supposed to reduce latency, and that means that it enables devices to talk to each other more easily, and it has to be in place for things like self-driving cars to work properly, right? That's the big picture implication. When it comes to the health concerns, there's a lot of debate among different scientists, and people are leaning toward there not being major health concerns, but it's still something that hasn't really been proven yet, so I'm skeptical.
We haven't talked about smart cars. Jeffrey, Tesla, of course, is one of on the cutting edge of that sort of thing with, you know, I'd say mixed results, not even talking about their exploding batteries.
Look, I think that Tesla is going to be remembered, particularly the Model S, as one of the biggest products of this decade. Because what it did, even if Tesla hasn't taken over the rest of the world beyond the Bay Area, though certainly seems to have taken over the Bay Area, what it has done is it has changed the notion of what a car can be. First of all, that it can be electric, and that can be a mass product, and it can be something that's sexy and cool that people want. Elon Musk has really done that.
And the S is relatively affordable, right?
So the S is the expensive one. So that's the one that came out at the beginning, earlier in the decade. And then the more recent one is the Model 3. So that's the one that's like 36 or 37K. But the other thing that I think Tesla has done is that it has really changed what a car can be. So they're now basically smartphones on wheels. The Tesla is always connected to the internet, constantly receiving software updates, and it knows where it's going. It actually is even taking video clips of where it goes and sending that back to Tesla so that it can get smarter about, you know, improving its self-driving capabilities. And that's an idea that has really spread to all car makers. And this coming model year, I have a piece in the Post today, this coming model year is going to be really a turning point, that it's going to be really hard to buy a new car in America without an internet connection. option.
How many of you own a car?
Sarah,
you're the outlier again.
Again.
But yeah, I mean, transportation has been revolutionized by all this. You talked about UberX at the beginning of the hour, but you know, all these rental opportunities you have with bikes and scooters and all those things. Looking into the next decade, what are you looking for? What are you anticipating to the extent that we can do that? Because things always seem to go in a different direction. But Jeffrey, what are you anticipating?
Well, one of the big promises of this decade that never happened, but there are still billions of dollars going into it, is this notion of the face computer. That's something that we wear in our glasses or in a contact lens, or who only knows where it'll actually go, but that will bring reality, a different slice of reality to our mind.
Brian, what about you?
Can I let Sarah go first? I have to.
Yes. I think in the next decade, like, if this decade was about, personalization and getting things to fit into what our ideal of the internet, I think the next decade is going to be about us shifting our behavior and what we do to perform well on the internet. And we're already seeing this a little bit. Some people mentioned going on vacation, going to the best picturesque spots just for Instagram. But I think we're really going to shift our behavior a lot more for the internet.
Brian, you're off the hook because we're out of time. But thank you all very much. Jeffrey Fowler from The Washington Post, Sarah Friar from Bloomberg, and Brian Chen from The New York Times. Thanks all for a really interesting conversation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Ariana Prale, Susan Britton, and Caroline Smith. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our intern is Sam Klein Markman. Our executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Some sad news to share with you. Former KQED senior producer and award-winning filmmaker Michael Schwartz passed away unexpectedly last week. His documentaries include In Defense of Food and Ending AIDS, The Search for a Vaccine. His latest film, Ornament of the World, will air on KQED and other PBS stations tonight at 8 p.m. And our condolences to Michael, his friends, and family. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.